Welcome to a study of the Book of Ephesians. Our speaker, Dr. Ken Boa, is president of Reflections Ministries and Trinity House Publishers. Today, he looks at the issue of trust. Here with our study is Dr. Ken Boa.
We are going to be focusing on one verse this morning because it is something that explores an entire universe of truth. This one verse from Ephesians chapter 4, we've arrived at verse 26, has huge implications for not only our own personal lives, but ultimately for a broader perspective on this world, indeed a Christian worldview. It relates to the issue of truth, not only in a sense of morality, but also in a sense of objectivity. Is there such a thing as an objective truth? And this is something that, of course, has been challenged in our own time. But the verse that I want us to focus on is in verse 26. After he spoke about this whole idea of putting off the old self in verse 22, laying aside the old self which is being corrupted in accordance with the lusts of deceit, that you be renewed in the spirit of your mind and put on the new self, which in the likeness of God has been created in righteousness and holiness of the truth. Key word there. So he says righteousness and holiness of the truth. Then he says in verse 25, therefore laying aside falsehood, speak truth each one of you with his neighbor, for we are members of one another. That's the verse I want to focus on, is verse 25. The whole idea of speaking the truth to one another. He's already used this image of speaking the truth in love in 4:15. And he's saying that this truth will, in fact, establish you. In fact, Jesus said that you shall know the truth. And what does it go? He go on to say? It'll liberate you. It'll set you free. And ultimately, biblical truth is not merely for intellectual attainment, but rather for personal transformation. This kind of truth that we're referring to is life transforming. This is not neutral. This is a revelation, and we respond to the revelation, and as we do so, it infuses not merely our minds, but also our hearts, and then our actions. So we go really from this level of who we are in Christ, and then how we think well, and then live well. And we want to be men whose lives are integrated and holistic. That is to say, that we have a right heart, a right head, and a right hands, if to look at it that way. The heart, the head, the hands, the being, the knowing, the doing. And all of those are immersed in this concept of truth. When we think about the whole area of truth-telling and lies, I came across this story my friend Max Anders used of a minister who spotted a group of small boys who were out in the church parking lot. And they were gathered around an irresistibly cute puppy, and they were making quite a commotion. So the minister walked over to them, and he said, well, what's going on here, boys? Well, we found this puppy, said one of the boys, and all of us want to keep it, so we're having a contest. The one who can tell the biggest lie wins the puppy. Shame on you boys, said the minister. I can't believe you would do such a thing, deliberately telling lies. Why, when I was your age, I never told a lie. The boys fidgeted and looked at one another nervously, and finally one boy said, okay, mister, you win the dog. Mark Twain once had this little quip. He said, truth, he said, may be eternal, but a lie told well is a thing of beauty and a joy forever. Well, so it would appear in our own culture that might be the case. We are really in a context in this world where the whole idea of what is true is being up for is now held up for grabs. And there is this fact-value distinction that I want to allude to in a little moment. But it's this idea that you can have something on the upper story that has to do with values, but facts are another thing entirely. And there is a loss of an integrated view of truth. Francis Schaeffer, years ago, referred to this. He was the first one that, one of the earliest writers that I read when I first became a believer in summer of 67, when I went to seminary in 1968, I came across Francis Schaeffer's first two books, and they were called Escape from Reason and The God Who Was There. And Francis Schaeffer used this idea of two stories, the lower story and the upper story. And a recent book just came out along these lines called Saving Leonardo by Nancy Piercy that I would actually encourage you to read because it really helps us understand the secular assault on mind, morals, and meaning. And it's, I think, an extraordinarily well-crafted piece of work. I'm not quite through with it yet, but I wanted just to mention how she picks up on Schaeffer's idea, and she draws a variety of distinctions. And one of those distinctions that she draws is the two-story concept of truth itself, where on the lower story, you have what are called facts. These are public. These are objective. And these are universal, the facts themselves. But then there's a divide. And on the upper story, we have values, as a term that we're using now. But that refers not to something public, but rather private. Something not objective, but rather subjective. Not universal, but relative. So beauty or morality and values and that sort of a thing can be regarded to be up for grabs. Often it comes out of a post-Enlightenment kind of scientism or naturalistic philosophy that seeks to eliminate all other forms of knowledge except scientific inquiry and consequently says if you can't measure it and quantify it and so forth, it can't really be truth, it's just subjective. And that also led to a divided view. A biblical worldview, I think, is much more robust than that. There's another contrast she draws. When in speaking about the whole idea of our view of humanity and how do we look at a person, there's another distinction that she draws. Once again, the lower story and the upper story. On the lower story, she has body. The human being is perceived as a biochemical machine, which is more of a modernistic perspective that really comes out of the notion that if we are merely the chance byproduct of time plus chance and the impersonal, if that's all we are, that we are an epiphenomenon of an impersonal process, undirected, then the upshot would be, if you're really logical about it, is there's no such thing as true consciousness, it's only an illusion. There's no distinction between the brain and the mind, they're one and the same. There's this loss, then, of this understanding of how the human being can really be a person who has even free will. Even freedom of will, we become deterministic robots on the lower level. People can't live that way. And because of that, there's an upper level, kind of a reaction to it. And the upper level, we have the area of the person. It's very fascinating to me how we now have come up with this thing that we call the person. And as long as the body is not a person, we can do whatever we want with it. It's when we call it a person, but people then get to define what a person is, and that's where it's loosey-goosey for sure. On the upper story, a person is an autonomous self, and that she relates to a more postmodern view. And so there's two different kind of reactions in understanding this realm of truth. Tying those together, she goes on to draw a third contrast between those two stories. On the lower level, she speaks of enlightenment. On the upper story, romanticism. And it's fascinating how that has become a real divide. In other words, people are kind of trying to live in two worlds at once, in a sense. On the one hand, when it suits them, they want to have a box, that we have this box of things, as it were. It's materialism. And it seems to be scientific on the one hand, seems to be objective. But because people cannot live as machines, there's this romantic kind of trend where we have this box of mind and it moves into idealism. And she does a terrific job in picking up where Schaeffer left off on this whole area of showing how not only philosophy, but also music and art have reflected worldviews in this way. Schaeffer himself picked that up originally from Hans Ruckmacher. Modern art and the Christian or the Bible. But the point here is that in our culture, we have this terrific divide that's taking place. So you have these trends, an enlightenment or modernistic perspective on the whole area of humanity and so forth, and a reaction to that, a more postmodern, but in my view, actually consistent with the logical implications of a modernistic worldview. I don't want to go into more detail than that. I'm sure this, you're all grasping this, and this is what you wanted in the morning. But at any rate, let me bring it down to brass tacks to illustrate what I have in mind. When it comes to truth and when it comes to error, a movie that comes to mind came out in 1983 was The Return of the Jedi. And some of you will remember that as part of the original Star Wars trilogy. I never forget in 1977 seeing the first movie in the trilogy at the Lowe State Theater in New York City. Everyone was jamming into the place there. And it said Episode 4. And I said, have I missed something? Where was I for Episodes 1, 2, and 3? Of course, it starts with the middle of the trilogy. And then it would ultimately go back and then to the future. But at any rate, this one, The Return of the Jedi, was the third in that trilogy. And here we have Darth Vader, and we have Obi-Wan Kenobi. And Obi-Wan Kenobi speaks to Luke Skywalker. And Luke Skywalker is very upset with Obi-Wan Kenobi because he never told him the identity of his father. Luke didn't. I hope I'm not spoiling anything for you here. But that Luke Skywalker's father was Darth Vader. You'd say that. I hope I'm not messing you up over here. But here's what's interesting in Obi-Wan's defense. Here's how he puts this. Even though he clearly misled and deliberately misled Luke Skywalker, he says this: "What I told you was true, from a certain point of view." Interesting expression. Luke, you're going to find that many of the truths we cling to depend greatly on our point of view. What did that just tell you? All truth is relative. It's up for grabs. What true for you, but not for me. You ever hear that expression? That's true for you. I'm happy for you, but that has nothing to do with me. And that's to disunite and disconnect the whole concept of truth. Reminds me of the story I heard about two Duke students who are, I'm avoiding Georgia and Tech. You notice what I'm deliberately making it Duke. He's got territory, so I'm not even touching that. But two Duke students who go away for the weekend. And because of a flat tire in the middle of the night, they got back late for the exam on Monday morning, and they asked the professor for permission to take the exam the next morning. And he agreed. And he sent them that morning into two separate rooms. And there were two questions on that exam. And one question was worth 5%, and the second question was worth 95%. Because, of course, they used the excuse of the flat tire. And guess what the 95% question was? Which tire? Which tire? Do you see what it comes down to now? True for you, but not for me. I'm not so sure about that, you see, because ultimately there are some things that we do, and frankly, we don't build buildings according to a postmodernist perspective. We don't want postmodernist architects and structural engineers. It doesn't work real well. Works well in the humanities and so forth. But at the end of the day, though, it turns out that there are some things that we actually live as if they are true. This is why I say if your bank called you and told you that you've overdrawn, and you said, that's not possible. I had $10,000 in my account. And the bank says, sir, you only had $900 in your account. Suppose you then said to them, that's true for you, but not for me. You see, how well would that go? We just clocked you at 90 miles an hour. True for you, but not for me, officer. I was going at 45. You know, it's all up for grabs. We know better than that. Common sense dictates that we live in a way that's more consistent with a more unified view of truth. That there are some things that we say that are true, that are good, and that are beautiful. And that those values we claim, have actual reality and not mere subjectivity when we refer to those kinds of things. And in fact, it's been said there's nothing more heinous than a beautiful theory murdered by a brutal gang of facts. You see the concept there? There are a lot of beautiful theories that are being murdered by brutal gangs of facts. And I believe there are a lot of those beautiful theories that are being spun in the university today. But they do not, they work well in an ivory tower, but you bring it down to reality and it's another matter entirely. C.S. Lewis was right when he spoke about the nature of truth and related it to Christianity as a worldview. And here he said in God in the Dock, one of the essays in this collection called God in the Dock, he said, Christianity is a statement which, if false, is of no importance, and if true, of infinite importance. The one thing it cannot be is of moderate importance. You catch the difference there? It's either utterly unimportant or it's infinitely important. It cannot be just moderately important. And yet I suggest to you that most people who claim to be followers of Christ see it as a moderately important thing. They compartmentalize their life, and they see some things that are spiritual and other things that are secular, and they make Christianity something that's a component of their life, but it's not actually of infinite importance. And Lewis, and I agree with him, is arguing that's not an option. If Jesus is who he claims to be, if the scriptures are what they claim to be, they tell us about the fundamental questions of life, which are what? What are the most basic questions anyone could ask?
Origin,
purpose, destiny. Those are the three fundamentals. Where did I come from? Why am I here? And where am I going? You could also add the other two questions. What's the problem and what's the solution in the human condition? And I'm submitting to you that apart from this revelation, mere empiricism on the one hand and rationalism on the other would never bring us to unified truth in those concepts. Empiricism has profound limits, and that's why scientific inquiry, while very valid within its limitations, is not the only way of coming to truth. There are many forms of knowledge. Can you think of another form of knowledge besides scientific knowledge? Oh, come on now. How about personal knowledge? Is it personal knowledge? How about historical knowledge? How about aesthetic knowledge? Moral knowledge? Religious knowledge? You with me on that? Those are all, and each of those has their own unique form of inquiry, but none of those has the whole market on the truth. There are many facets in this world. And if we limit it merely to human understanding, we're never going to arrive at answers to the fundamental questions of origin, purpose, and destiny. And if we look at it merely from the philosophical standpoint, we're certainly not going to arrive at answers there, because if you notice, the history of philosophy, when studied, turns out to be a history where it's a tree that gets further and further apart. The branches are getting further apart, not unified. There's not a unified vision of understanding. And that's why I believe that Pascal was right. We're gambling everything on a vision of truth. We are putting our eternal destiny on the line in the claim that Jesus is who he claims to be, and that if he is who he claims to be, it has everything to do with the way I live this day. Everything to do with the way I run my business, everything to do with the way I manage my finances, the way I approach friends and my spouse and relationships of every sort. It has everything to do with relationships. It has everything to do with trust and quality of life. It's not trivial. Pascal's wager effectively could be put in these terms: should a man be in error in supposing the Christian religion to be true, he could not be a loser by mistake. Why would that be? Suppose you really believe that Jesus was who he claimed to be, and then it turned out that he wasn't. You wouldn't be around to know, because you'd be annihilated. You understand? You'd be merely food for the worms. But then he goes on to say, but how irreparable is his loss, and how inescapable is his danger, should he err in supposing it to be false. That's why you have everything to lose and nothing to gain by denying Christ, everything to gain and nothing to lose by not. Even if the odds were 90% that God didn't exist, if I were a gambling man, I think I know where I'd put my money. However, the interesting thing is, as time goes by, and I've told you about this many times, new evidence from the nature of the origins of the universe, that the universe had a beginning, that it is exquisitely finely tuned for life, that the nature of even the simplest living cell is so complex that it's unfathomable, and that, as well, we are beings who are surrounded by information. Indeed, you have something on the order of 75 to 100 trillion cells in your body, each with 6 feet of DNA, and each of those 6 feet of DNA has more information than several sets of the Encyclopedia Britannica. Where does information come from? I'm arguing, in fact, that as science continues to go along, actually the evidence is moving us more and more in favor of an origin that's not impersonal, but of a mind that's stored. Because information, we know, never comes from something that is not a mind. But that's another story. My point is that Pascal was right in this understanding that, and another way of putting it, I'd far rather live as I do if that Christianity is true. I'd rather really live as if God existed and then find out that he didn't than to live as if he didn't exist and then find out that he did. It's another way of looking at that. You see the concept? I'm going to say this. Agnosticism is not a neutral position. A lot of people have this posture of a neutrality. You cannot be epistemologically neutral. There is a commitment in any worldview, and ultimately the issue is going to be that every man and woman, everyone who's ever existed on this planet, those who have gone before and those who will come, will have to bow the knee before Christ. Every person, if the scriptures are true, will have to acknowledge him. And the issue is going to be, what did you do with me? What did you do with my truth claims? And the idea, the barrier, the divide, is that those, he said, who know him, enter into his fullness of joy. That's why the best words you can ever hear are, well done, good and faithful servant, enter into the joy of your masters. Your joy relates to your relationship with me. And why the worst words one can ever hear are, depart from me. Jesus is saying this, for I never knew you. He is saying that your ultimate joy or your ultimate loss relates to what you do with him. This is not a neutral game. And to posture neutrality in light of a person who's made the claim that he in fact gave his life for you is not an option. Either you accept him or reject him, but to ignore him is tantamount to rejecting him. It's not an actual option. Jack?
That last verse also involves more than just an intellectual assent to that.
It was more than just intellectual. Jesus, this is where I've many times said that when you look at the scriptures from beginning to end, what do you have? It's filled it with rich propositions. Now, propositional truth makes the claim that it corresponds to some kind of reality, historical and otherwise. Now, propositional truth is one thing. A person can believe in the Nicene Creed and quote it, and the Apostles' Creed, the Athanasian Creed. They can memorize those things. In fact, a lot of churchgoers have and don't know Jesus. They have religion without Christ. They have intellectual assent without personal relationship. They've limited merely to the propositional level, whereas actually truth takes us from proposition to person. And Jack's absolutely right, that at the end of the day, the propositions point beyond themselves to a person that must be encountered, and that all of life is relational, that the most important thing about your whole life, it all comes down to this, is whether you know God or not, and whether you're going to be with him or not. At the end of the day, Jesus said, I gave everything, in order for you to enter into a right relationship with me. It was not cheap, because you didn't have a prayer of earning it. And because of that, you recognize then that we have this relationship that is something that now is secure, not because it's based upon something we did. In fact, if it was based 1% on my performance, I would be very insecure indeed. If it was 99% based upon my Christ's performance and 1 on mine, how am I doing in that 1%? Especially if the standard is perfection and that God cannot compromise his standards. About 50 times I've given you the following phrase. I still hope that eventually some of you will learn it. I am not confident of this, but we will see. How do you like that for a setup? Some of you do know it by now. The righteousness that God requires is that righteousness which his righteousness requires him to require. Have you all heard that before? Have you all learned it? I want you to learn that.
I don't know what it means.
Oh, come on, Robert. Or what? So that God's righteousness requires him to require perfection. He cannot compromise. He cannot grade on a curve. He cannot lower the standards. Remember when you were in grade school and there was an incredibly difficult test and everyone failed the test except for one nerd who got 100? You know? No, that wasn't me. That wasn't me. No. You got to know something about me. I was the class clown. I was just a dork, and I didn't do any study at all. In fact, I prided myself on how little I read. I think I maybe read maybe about 10 books by the time I graduated from college. And it was after college I began to learn. But I was a lazy good-for-nothing in school. So some of us are late bloomers. There's hope for all of us. But I was not that nerd, no. But you see, we call that a what? A curve breaker. Well, somebody got 100, so it couldn't have been an unfair test. You see how that works? You see that mindset? Well, that's how it is with us. You see, if in fact God did grade in a curve and he said, okay, you can be up to 49% evil. Come on in, but just don't let me catch you. What kind of a hell? Heaven would be hell if you stop and think about it, because evil increases at compound interest. But suppose a person was basically good. Oh, come on. So he's 51% good, but he's got this other... It's a nonsensical concept that we're inviting God to actually just lower his standards and compromise his integrity. And actually, what standard would you use? Are you comparing yourself with Mother Teresa and Albert Schweitzer? Or are you comparing yourself with Jack the Ripper and the Boston Strangler? It makes a good deal of difference. If it's the latter, you might feel that you can make it. You know, I've told you this many times, but a lot of people really have this silly notion. I encountered, ask the average person on the street, and they're going to have some variation of this. How do you get into heaven? And it's going to be some kind of a ladder of perfection, and they figure that there's a cutoff point, and everyone believes that the rung they've attained is just above the cutoff point. But what basis do they have for making this claim? You see, how do you know how well you're doing? And the fact is that the scriptures say, friend, unless you are perfect in thought, word, and deed, you're not going to enter into a relationship with me, because I cannot have fellowship with that which is darkness. God is light, and in him there is no darkness at all. He cannot have fellowship with that which is contrary to him. Hence the need for God, who is just, to make an incredible payment so he could justify the ungodly. Hence, he underwrites the cost of his creation and the cost of the fall by taking it upon himself so that he could now offer his grace, so that at the cross, the greatest combination of the wrath of God and the holiness of God on the one hand and the love of God and the grace of God on the other hand is seen, whereby he who knew no sin became sin on our behalf, so that we might have the righteousness of God in him. And I know I've given you that verse many times before, but it's things we need to remember and review. 2 Corinthians 5:21 tells us that Christ who knew no sin becomes sin on our behalf, so that we might become God's righteousness. He takes our account, puts it on his on the cross. He's the one who takes the weight of the sin upon himself, the one who is called the sin bearer, who's come to the Lamb of God, who takes away the sins of the world. But that's only half the story. He not only took away my sin and put it on his account, but what did he also do? What's the other half of that story, that verse? So we might become the righteousness of God in him. What does it say there? The other half is this, that he gave us his righteousness. Now that's a deal you're never going to get anywhere else. He took our iniquity. He who deserved the love of God receives the wrath, so that we who deserve the wrath of God receives the love. Thus God could be just and still justify the ungodly. Talk about an incredible purchase price. That we're not dealing with just merely games here. We're dealing with relationships, and we're dealing with a choice. And the dignity of choice, as being in the image of God, we are moral agents whose choices really shape our destiny, ultimate destiny. And consequently, the dignity of choice invites us to say, what are you going to do with this Jesus? Are you going to accept him or reject him? Often when I hear people speak about these things, I ask them, do you really know the gospel? Have you ever read the gospels? What does the Bible talk about? Because I tell people, and I appeal sometimes to their intellectual pride, you know, it might be a good idea for you to read for yourself and some of the accounts about Jesus so you'd be more intellectually informed before you accept him or reject him. Of course, if I can get a person to do that, I got them right where I want them. Because the power of Scripture is very, very great when a person exposes themselves to it, at least with the semblance of an open mind. Let me see if they have any questions so far on this. This issue of truth, then, I think is very critical. And I haven't even gotten into, I have a whole bunch of verses I was going to use from the Old Testament and the New. Yeah.
This is a little bit off the subject, where we're confronted from our pulpits and our churches many times that, you know, we distribute our wealth, and they go into a direction that I find unacceptable. Yet when I read the Bible and it says, love your neighbor as yourself, there's a kind of a rubber meets the road there, and I don't know what the truth is.
Right. He's asking this question about we get certain messages that are mixed messages, and one would be that we ought to distribute the wealth and that sort of a thing, and it would be more of a mindset, really, of socialism. Everybody needs to, you know, everybody gives it away versus a more free market economy. And I'm not going to go into that discussion this morning, although I do think we may have reached the tipping point and passed it between a free market economy and a social market economy. I believe we've done that already. But I was predicting that when I created the Decline of Nations DVD 5 years ago, and I predicted that sort of thing. I think we've already done that. However, having said that, in fact, my view is that the best thing I can do for others is, in fact, to have the resources so that I can give them away. And to have resources, I need to create wealth. And to create wealth, I need to have engage in enterprise. And ultimately, that's where, you see, the government only takes what people who are earning money and giving it away. They don't make money. They take money and give it away. But my point is that that creation of wealth is not a question merely of greed. Milton Friedman, if you look up his little video on the Donahue show that he did a number of years ago. It's the best summary I know. Look it up on YouTube. Milton Friedman on greed. He says, who's not greedy? Is the Politburo not greedy? Are communists not greedy? He says, actually, at the end of the day, the best thing you can do to help people get away from the grinding pain of poverty that Donahue was describing is to actually create a context in which there are resources available so that you can actually give it away. That's why later on, we're going to talk about this very soon, he says in Ephesians chapter 4:28, he who steals must steal no longer, but rather he must labor, performing with his own hands what is good, so that he will have something to share with the one who has need. Do you see the idea? We are called to share, but we're also called to be wise and prudent and to create resources. And in fact, capitalism is something that, in my view, is a product of this worldview. Now, this is totally politically incorrect. The book to read on this might be The Victory of Reason by Gerald Stark. He discusses how the creation of wealth is actually something, and you've all heard of the Protestant work ethic and that sort of a thing. But the bottom line is the truth in Scripture is unchanging. How you apply it is going to be contextual. But I think what we need to do is to take a biblical worldview and to see how it relates. And the Scriptures actually encourage hard work and the creation of resources. Read the book of Proverbs sometime, and you'll see that it's talking about that. Not wealth suddenly gained like that, but rather something that is developed, not by speculation, but by development and that sort of thing. So this whole realm of truth, then, I just want to suggest as I tie it together, that lying, when we do not tell the truth, alienates us from God and violates the persons we become in Christ, and also moves us into the realm of the fear of the liar and the father of lies, John 8:44 says. And by the way, the fundamental lie that he wanted us to believe and still wants us to believe is that he wants to deceive us into thinking that God is not looking out for our best interests. That's basically why temptation is so effective, to make us believe the lie. And I believe that the only power he has over us is when we believe that kind of a lie. At the end of the day, truth is what makes true relationships possible. And if you want to have close fellowship in a marriage, you speak the truth to one another. If you want to have close fellowship in a parent-child relationship, and with friends, you speak truth to one another. And that's why this whole biblical vision of truth is so critical. And therefore, this idea of truth not only is related to a comprehensive worldview, but it's also related to day-by-day practice, where we speak the truth even to our own hurt. And we speak the truth in love. And that's the context that I want us to end up with, Ephesians 4:15 again. We want to be truth bearers, but we also want to be lovers. I've seen a lot of churches that are all truth and very little love, and other churches are a lot of sloppy sentimentality but very little truth. And in my view, a biblical vision of love is founded on truth, because God is the foundation, the wellspring of truth. And what is God? God is love. When he loves, he's being himself. So here we have righteousness and peace kissing one another. We have truth and love merging together. And the better we know God, the more we will be willing to trust him. And as we trust him, we will not be succumbing to the kinds of lies that we often try to use to create what we perceive to be in our best interests. And that we know that truth-bearing, even when it's to our hurt, will actually be the best course of action. And that is a wise way for us to live.
Thank you for listening to this talk, which is part of a series of messages by Dr. Ken Boa. To order additional talks on CD or MP3, or to learn about any of Dr. Boa's other Bible-based teachings, go to our web ministry at kenboa.org. That's kenboa.org. Or call 1-800-DRAW-NEAR. That's 1-800-372-9632.